Thank you, folks. Hope you had a good break. I didn't. We just visited, and that's good. That's what a break for, anyway. I tried to pick up where I left off, and then that I've already spent more time than I normally do. That what I'm talking about takes a good bit of time to do that to thoroughly and to deal with the way it has to be dealt with. And but anyway, we'll pick up there and then go on. By the way, an informer told me that some folks were having a little bit of trouble hearing. Now, it's rare for anybody to tell me to speak up. You know, they normally say, can you hold it down a little? You know? But if anybody's having trouble, give me a signal. Because that I'm young, but my voice is old, you know. So just give me a signal and we'll rev it up for sure. I was telling you about that that thing. Put it in context. I really believe that, you know, once you get started in the steps, you know, you get the foundation with your inventory and the fact that you really got the illness and you got it big time. It doesn't do much to touch alcoholism, and it doesn't do much to touch the things that eat us alive. And the thing about amends is that they're not just nice to do. I think they're critical to do. And I honestly believe that until we make amends, we drag that baggage with us forever. It never goes away. And what it does is eat our lunch on a regular basis. And so that's one reason I like to deal with amends a little bit. And because they're the keys to freedom, I truly believe. And so I'll finish telling you about that, because that's as difficult amends as you could possibly imagine. They weren't the hardest to make, but they were the most difficult to conceptualize and to get up the nerve to do. You know, when you've caused the death of two people in families, that is not an easy mission to try to go deal with that at all. You know, the most tempting thing is to hide, for God's sakes. But the freedom doesn't come that way. And so, you know what happened? I brought you up to the point where I wanted to make amends and started to do indirect amends, which I continue to do to this day. I tell you just one ironic thing, that when you ask God for help, you better be ready, because he'll give it to you, and sometimes more than you want. And so when I started trying to pursue how I could do indirect amends to folk who died because of my negligence, that was a tough deal. But what I've always asked for is for God to help me do what I need to do. And I can't tell you how, I mean, I could if I took all night, but I can't tell you how many opportunities I've had to do things that were absolutely direct amends and could not be denied by me or anybody else. Now, that accident happened on the 3rd of May in 56. And I have never specifically done anything to cause anything to happen on the 3rd of May. Never. But I've had, God knows, the opportunities. I spoke to 5,000 young people in one day, in two groups of 2,500, about the very kind of issues that resulted in those young folks dying. And I didn't plan it. It was on the 3rd of May. And it's a step in that direction. And I did a television interview with a public broadcasting system. They wanted to do an interview and assured that it would be completely anonymous. And completely anonymous is almost wishful thinking. It's hard to come by. And the guy told me, have you folks seen my coat? How do you like it? I wear that sucker all the time. And but I'm getting out of it, if I may. It's supposed to be cold in Denmark. Y'all had something wrong.
Thank you, buddy. Where's your water?
Water. They won't give me any. They put me against drinking ever since I got here, about to die. Here it is. I'm lying. I was trying to make up a sad story. So I failed again. But it is warmer than I thought in Denmark. But you know, they did this film, and I'm sure you've seen that. I call it the Rubik's Cube thing, where they're going to mask somebody's identity, and they got this thing, looks just like a Rubik's Cube and the moving parts. And the guy said, there's nobody could possibly identify that. We're going to change your voice, so they're not going to recognize the voice. I said, okay, fine. He wanted to pay me. I said, no, you don't pay for this, buddy. No way. And I said, if you want to do something, give a donation to the National Council on Alcoholism and put it in your name, not mine. Just do it. And so I made that movie, interview in that thing. And about six months later, I guess, I got a phone call from a woman I knew in North Dakota. And so she identified herself, and I knew her well. She's a fine member. And she said, Tom, did you make a movie? I said, girl, are you drinking? What are you talking about, making a movie? No, I haven't made any movie. What's wrong? And she said, well, I swear to God, I think I saw you in a movie just a while back. I said, well, tell me about the movie, because it must have been blacked out, because I haven't done it to my knowledge. And so she told me what it was, and when she started describing it, I knew what it was. It was that television interview. And I said, my God, that thing was totally anonymous. How could you possibly know it was me? She said, I recognize your nose. I said, oh my God, is it that bad? You know, and she said, pretty bad. My fault. Some careless person hit me in the wrong place and flattened it out. But anyway, that was just one. And over and over and over on the 3rd of May, things have come up that just absolutely deny explanation other than the fact that it's the opportunity to pray for. And so they continue. There's no doubt, you know, I'm the oldest AA member, oldest male in my state. I'm also the most active. And it's not because I'm the Energizer Bunny. I'm somebody who sees indirect amends in much of what I do. There's no question about that. You know, obviously I can't change history, but maybe my experience could be helpful to somebody else in dealing with something like that themselves, or with maybe not having to deal with something like that. You never know. You know, I just do what I do and then pray for results. And so there's no doubt that I'm not as active as I am just because I'm the Energizer Bunny, but because it is directly related to you know, that the only way you can make a new life is make up for that old one and get that taken care of. And so that's been a continuing kind of a process, and always will be. The families, on the other hand, were a different matter. Because the families were conscious and alive, and they'd suffered the loss of loved ones. It was two young people, a boy and a girl. They were out on a little high school outing, and the families. I had contacted the families, even as just a guy locked up in jail, as a human being. I knew that I needed to contact the families, and so I had some street people that I hustled around with to contact them, ask them if they'd be willing to hear from me. Both families said no, understandably. And so you got to shut the door. Your book says we don't find our relief at somebody else's expense. Eh? You can't barge in and force amends on somebody. And so I had to accept that, but that doesn't mean it goes away. And so what I did is when I started putting amends lists together and did the 8-step and I got to those people, and I did something on steps I normally don't do. You know, the 8-step says made a list of people who harm become willing to make amends to them all. I added a word to that step. Behind willingness, I put the word opportunity. So my prayer was not just for willingness, but for opportunity to make a direct amends. I never did one single thing to cause that to happen. I mean, that explains a lot of stuff that happens in my life. I don't know about yours, but I have stuff that mystifies me all the time that happens that I have nothing to do with. And so what happened, I'm just going on with my life. I'm extremely active in AA, and the life was doing well. And I got a call one day from an attorney in the state of Michigan where that had occurred. And the guy identified himself, and he said, Tom, the families have entered a lawsuit. And the premise is that that what happened was not really your fault, that the young folks jumped back to avoid another vehicle and jumped into yours. And so they're taking that to court. Well, you can imagine how the mind of an alcoholic is going to jump. And so right away I'm thinking relief, you know, relief. But it doesn't change anything, eh? It doesn't change a thing. And when I thought about that, it didn't make any difference how it happened. You don't mitigate a crime like that. There is no way. You can't minimize that. It's as serious as it gets. And no matter what anybody else did, nothing negates the fact that I am blind, drunk, blacked out, operating a vehicle on Main Street. Doesn't change a thing. And so that was a two-second kind of a just like grabbing a rope when you're drowning. But I had to turn it loose real quick. It didn't change anything. And so he finished telling me what he's doing, and he said, Tom, the families would like for you to come up and testify at that hearing. And I said, well, my God, I'd be glad to do it. I'll do anything. But I can't help. I mean, I'm no help. In my own trial, they put me on the stand, and all I can say is, I'm sorry, I don't know. Blackouts are hell. That's not bad memory. It's a complete erasure of stuff in your mind. It just never registered. And so I had no testimony. They asked me a question. All I can say is, I'm sorry, I don't know. And so I said, I don't think it'll be much help. And they said, well, the families think it would. I said, all right, you got it. I'll be there. And so I went up. Now, you want to talk about walking across your own grave. Went back. The hearing was going to be in the same room where I was tried. That's an eerie feeling, to walk right back in where your life did an abrupt turn in a different direction. I didn't know it was going to be a good direction, but I just knew it was the end of the road when I walked in. So I walked in, really weird feeling. They tell you where to sit, and you normally don't put offended and offender close together. I mean, that's just common sense. It doesn't have to be law. That's just common sense. So they seated me in the same area, you know, like the family's sitting there, and I'm sitting over here on the end. And a little uncomfortable, but it was all right. I mean, it's fine with me, but I didn't want to do anything to them. And so they're going through with the trial. And you know how the judges will do at some point? They will call a recess and take the attorneys to chambers to go over laws or something. And so he did. He called a recess, took the lawyers back. And the bailiff, now don't ask me to explain it because I can't. You know, my boss does a lot of things I can't explain. Yeah, I found out his rule book ain't exactly like ours. So, and what happened? I can't explain it. I can just report. But we're sitting there, and the bailiff came back, and he went over to the families and gestured for them to come with him. And I thought it was a potty break. And so, you know, the families got up and walked down the hall with him. A couple minutes, he came back, came over to me, and gave me the same option, I thought. And so he gestured for me to go down the hall. Now, don't ask me to explain it because it's not right. I know it's not right. Took me down the hall. We came to a door, and he swung it open and gestured for me to go in. And I walked in. I don't know if you've ever been shocked enough in your life that the whole world looked like a flashbulb going off. And I walked in that room and I saw what it was. Here were both families alone. And he's gestured for me to go in. Now, my reaction was my prayers were answered. That was not my reaction. My reaction was run, because that scared to death. And then I said to myself, well, old boy, looks like your prayers have been answered. So I went in. And I'll never understand it, but I don't need to understand it. I can just report it. But I went in. I walked over to the first family, asked them to speak to them. They greeted me like I was a family member. They truly did. I mean, I've never been more welcomed by anybody in my life. They tell me how much they appreciated me being there, what I was trying to do. It was almost like family greeting me. It couldn't have been any warmer. And so I told them that what my mission was, that I needed to make amends to the extent that I could, and told them how I felt about what had happened and what I wanted to say to them. And I intended to devote a great deal of my life to try to do things that might compensate a little bit for that, you know, and the kind of stuff that I thought I might do. that family could not have been more forgiving. I mean, it'd be impossible to be more forgiving. I wasn't asking for forgiveness. All I wanted was just to let me say to you what I need to say. And when I finished, they hugged me just like a family reunion. And then I went over to the other family, and it was a little different story. The other family was an Eastern European immigrant family who'd come over here from one of the border states, and they were first generation and still had difficulty with language. And it was a very patriarchal group, you could tell. You know, the father was kind of leading the deal. When I went over, they were at conversation, and the father saw me, and he came out and met me. And so I told him what I was there for. We shook hands, and he said, "Well, we appreciate you coming." And I said, "Is there any chance I can talk with the families?" And he said, "Hold on." And he went over back into the family circle and had a conversation with him. And then came back, and he said, "No, you can't speak with the family. Speak to me." And I said, okay, I will. And so I said to him what I wanted to say. And then he went back in the family thing again, and then came back, and he said, "I'm sorry, we can't forgive. Please don't bother us again." Well, you have to accept that. I mean, you can't steamroll it. You can't push past that. But I tell you, in all honesty, that my heart goes out to that family, because the other family's free. Eh? They're free. They've not carrying the hate. They put it under the heading of understanding or whatever, and they're free. You know, they're able to function with comfortably. The other family probably never will, unless they let up and let that hate get out of their hearts. You know, that I'm sponsoring a guy right now who has it's a different story, but it's the same consequence. He had a little boy that was killed in an accident in front of his house, and it was a complete accident. There was no drunk driving or anything else. It was just a totally unavoidable accident. Nobody was arrested. It was just one of those tragic things that happens every day. And he can't forgive. And I cannot get him to take any action to address it. And so for 20 years now, in recovery, this guy has carried that bitterness every day of his life. And so, anyway, that's exactly what that is. And I regret that. But I have to accept it. You know, I cannot push past it. My prayer is still for opportunity. You know, we're all getting old now. There's a likelihood it will never happen, but if it does, I'll welcome the opportunity. So that's pivotal. It's pivotal. Now, certainly, thank God, most people don't have that heavy an issue to deal with. Many do, but thank God most don't. For most, they deal with some negotiation and just conversation and try to find some pathway for reconciliation. But I guess my point is, our steps are a powerful tool, and those steps are what makes me free to engage in life and take a place and make some contribution. And so that was extremely, extremely important for me. And so, you know, when I left the institution, all of this happened right after I was out, but when I left the institution, I was a well-prepared guy. I was a good, solid member of AA. Yeah, I wasn't somebody who hoped to be someday. I already was. I was as active in the program, in the institution, as I am now. And so I was tremendously active. I was a tremendously rewarded guy while I was still locked up. I didn't have anything to call me on, but I got called over a loudspeaker or something to go to some building. Went in, and it was the State Parole Commission. Well, I wasn't eligible for anything. I mean, you with a 15-year max, you normally do one-fourth the max. And so I was nowhere near that. And I thought, what on earth are they going to see me for? And so I went in, and the chairman of the parole commission met me, and he knew who I was just from looking at the record, and introduced himself, and he said, "You probably wonder why you're here." I said, "Well, yeah, I do kind of wonder why I'm here." And he said, "Well, what it is, about once every 10,000 cases, we pick one that we think is a remarkable example of restoration. And he said, we decided to take a look at you. And I said, well, that's quite an honor, you know, and I really appreciate that. But he said, let me be real straight with you. We're not going to parole you because the crime is too great and the time served is too small. And I told him as sincerely as I was capable of doing, I said, I agree with you 100%. Well, there's a rule of reason. It's not a matter of just legality. There's a rule of reason. And there is no adequate punishment. But there's got to be at least enough punishment to at least look like action's been taken. And so I fully understood that. And I sincerely meant it, that I fully agreed with that. He said, what this assures is that you'll go out on your first eligibility. And I said, okay, that's good. And he told the truth. The day I was eligible, I was ready to go. And they opened the door. I was extremely active in AA. I think I was the secretary of the group at the time. And I'll tell you this. There's never been a human, I don't believe, who hated a penitentiary any worse than this guy. I hated every second that I was there. I hated that mind-boggling numbness of it. I demanded to despise that kind of meaningless stuff. And good God, I despised it. But I was a good citizen. I was a darn good citizen. And it was because of the program. And the night I was getting ready to leave, I'm packing my belongings, you know, and it didn't take much. You know, probably a cigar box would have been enough to get everything I owned, you know. And so I'm packing up, and I found myself thinking, I need a couple more days to finish up some stuff in AA. Now, I didn't tell anybody. I wouldn't have told anybody I needed one more second because I was ready to go, big guy. I was ready to go. And I wouldn't have stayed. I don't care if I was to meet Bill Wilson. I was boogieing because I flat knew it. I knew that AA was my lifeline. I knew that. I had preparations made long before I was eligible to be released. I knew exactly where I was going. I knew where my home group was going to be. I knew who I was going to talk with. Nobody did it for me. I did it for myself and had that lined up because I knew that this was my lifeline. The day I walked out of that institution, I knew at the pit of my soul that I would never go through that again. I would never go through it. And that didn't mean I'm too macho and I'm too smart and nobody will ever catch me like that again. That's not what I meant. I meant I'll do whatever it takes. I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was my lifeline. You know, I'm an alcoholic. That's who I am. And I knew that if I was going to be free, this program was what was going to make me free. So I walked out. I got immediately in touch with somebody the day I hit the street and talked to the guy. He welcomed me home. He said, you want to go to a meeting tonight? I said, what a great idea. And so we went to a meeting. And I tell you something. Apparently, we don't have quality control. I mean, we got a lot of things to fly the AA flag. That doesn't mean everything's the same thing. You know, that. And the first meeting I went to on the street, I swear to God, was the worst meeting I'd ever been to. If we'd had a meeting that bad in the penitentiary, somebody would have got hurt. I mean, they ain't going to do some junk like that. That was just goofy. And I thought, man, is this it? Is this what we're going to have? And I live 25 miles from the city. And I said, shoot, I'm going to town, man. I'm not going to stay here in this rinky-dink stuff. I'm going to get where the action is. And then a troubling thought, if you get too serious about the program, got to watch out. It'll screw up your life. So I got visited with kind of troubling thought. I'm 3.5 years in the program. When do you become responsible? When do you step up to the plate? When do you get into the action and try to make something happen instead of running? Yeah. And the answer was troubling, right now and right here. And so that's exactly what I did. I went to work. Had the marvelous experience that what had happened was a tragic thing. They only had one group, and they had an older couple who basically looked after the group, kept things in tow. They had an unfortunate fire in the house, and both burned in their home. So the leadership, such little as it was gone. And the only thing left was one old guy. He was a good old guy, that guy that took me to the first meeting. But I saw my work. Now, I'm just walking out of an institution. I've done a lot of service inside the institution, but I never done anything on the street. I never had done anything organizing, stuff like that. Didn't do everything brilliantly, but I worked hard, I'll tell you that. And so I started building. If you want to take a look at what that experience was like, look right at the end of the book, on the last page of the text, on the 164. It talks about when you get to a town, what do you do when it ain't there? You go to work, you start building, you create the fellowship you crave, eh? That's exactly what I started doing. Great experience. Great experience. We don't do a lot of 12-step calls now. I guarantee you we did then. My mother had been on more 12-step calls than 90% of the members of AA. Because, I was a handsome young dude when I walked out of there. I've gotten over it fairly well. But, I was a stud. And I knew they were all going to be panting after me. And I'd had some guidance from my first sponsor. He said, I never have forgotten it nor violated it. He said, now, Tom, there are women in AA. But I want you to understand something, that where you're concerned, they're not women. They're alcoholics. Leave them alone. Well, I heard what he said. I'd rather kiss the cobra than to mess with an AA woman. I just wasn't going to do it, man. But when you're the only guy in town, you get in some ticklish situations. And I made one 12-step call on a female by myself, and I learned the wisdom of what my sponsor said. Now, we both escaped pure, but that was the one and only. From that time on, I took a woman with me if it was a woman. I don't care who it is. My mother, she literally has been on more 12-step calls than most folks. My sister, girlfriends, hitchhiker, I don't care who it is. Somebody's going with me. And wise, I've never regretted that advice either. The last woman I had a 12-step call on, my wife went with me. And she had some interest in looking after her guy. So she went with me. And went over, and I swear to God, you never know about people. She'd been in Al-Anon for many years, but you never know about people. And we walked into this gal's room, and it was a typical pigsty. You kind of thing. And I was watching my wife as much as I was a girl. But I thought, how in the world is she going to react to this? We do not tidy up when we're drunk in a room in a hotel. And so we walked in, and I'm watching her. I don't know if it's teaching or not, but she moved in just like she'd been doing it all of her life. She walked in. All I'm doing is watching them. She did a great job and got sober. And the only thing that hurt my feelings was about every 2 weeks, they go to lunch. I don't ever get to go. They never invited me. I'm the one who saved her life, for God's sakes. And she's over feeding my wife all the time. And but you never know what's happening. That gal came to me one time. She said, "You know that my dad's dead, don't you?" And I said, Yeah, you told me that." And she said, "Do you know that I'm getting married?" I said, "No, I didn't know that." And I said, "But good for you if that's what you want to do." And she said, "Well, I want you to give me away in the wedding." And I said, "God, isn't anybody else?" And she said, "No, I want you to do it. I want you." I said, "Well, I'd be glad to give you away. Good God, I'd give you to anybody now, girl. You aggravate me bad." But what a privilege, eh? What an honor. What an honor to do that. So, but a lot of good stuff. A lot of good stuff happened like that. I was praying hard for a woman. And not for me, but we needed one in the fellowship. I couldn't just run my family forever on doing stuff, and just odd folks got hold of. So I'm praying for a woman, and there was one moved into town, and she was from California, and she looked like she was from California. That girl, she was jacked up right. Stones on everything. Everything showed had a rock on it. Every guy in town's pulse rate went up quite a bit. And every woman in town who was married to a drunk got mad. But we had a marvelous time. And In all these years, I've only sponsored two women. I make it a point that I think boys play with boys and girls play with girls. And I sponsored two women. One was that woman from California. There was nobody else there. And I was just so glad to see her. I'd have sponsored the devil if he'd come. But anyway, I took her on. And I kept her for about 40 years till she died. And then I had another one. I had a buddy that was always goosing me about something. He left me a woman he was sponsoring in his will when he died. Oh, my God. Boy, I knew he'd do anything to get a last blow in. You know, so here he comes. I still got that dinghy. Yeah, she. Well, don't send anything to North Carolina. But she is dinghy. She really is. And she's a trip. So anyway, I'm only two. But those were some wonderful years in a way. Yeah, we talked a good bit out at Reed talking about CPC and PI, how we get linked up with people who capture drunks and how we can get them moved into AA and that kind of stuff. Let me tell you how I did CPC when I was trying to get AA going in that town. One night I had a 12-step call, and that was daily. I had a 12-step call. And he was the first kind of management level guy I'd had. You know, most of them was just kind of working guys and gals. And this guy was kind of a leader type guy. And so, you know, the rule, people either want to get sober or quite often just want to get a drink. And so he was trying to get away from his wife. He wanted to drink. That was pretty obvious and I caught on. I've always had just a basic ground rule that I won't let a guy drink till I'm convinced I can't help him. And then if I'm convinced I can't help him, I might even buy him one. And at least I'll help him buy one if he wants to. But that's been my ground rule. And so I had this guy, and it was pretty apparent after a while that he was just trying to get away from Mama so he could go get something to drink. And so I screwed around with him about 3 o'clock in the morning. And finally, I said, tell me where your favorite bootlegger is. I thought I knew everyone in the county. So he named one, and I'd never heard of it. So we went up there. And it was just typical joint. It looked like an opium den in Calcutta or something, just drunk, stretched out all over the floor and everywhere. And I went in with this guy. He went over there and bought a bottle of something. I don't know what it was. I thought I'd drunk anything known to man, but I don't think I ever drank anything that bad. Yeah, I drank some hydraulic brake fluid one time. Didn't know what it was, but I don't think it's any worse than what he bought. I mean, that was rough-looking liquor. And about the time he bought the liquor, they never raided a bootleg joint. That was a major industry in that county. Nobody raided bootleggers. They made an exception that night. All at once, squad cars came in from everywhere. And they had circled the place, and here came the stormtroopers. These guys came in there, and they're dragging these drunks out, you know, putting them in there, going to go lock them up for disturbing the cockroaches or something. I don't know what they put them. And so they're loading them up. And I'm standing over there against the wall looking like a young Ivy League student. And this one cop kept looking at me, you know. Finally, he couldn't stand it anymore. He came over and he said, Mister, what are you doing? And I said, well, you probably wouldn't believe it. And he said, well, try me. And so I told him, and he said, you're right. That's hard to believe. And I said, well, I'm sorry about that. And he gave me the drunk. They've taken everybody else to jail. He gave that one to me. He gave me that rot gut liquor and that guy. And from then on, he gave me hell. That's how CPC and PI got started in my town. Because that guy went back to the jail, put my name on the wall, and said, if you get trouble with a drunk and you don't know what to do with him, call this guy. Call him. And boy, they took him at his word. They ran me ragged with that thing. But that's how it got started. It was great fun, eh? Great fun. You know, just building the group, watching it come alive, watching people get involved in it, watch people get doing the deal. And a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I'd gotten a job, grungy job. And I'd had a little, you know, when I'd sober up every once in a while, we tend to make good appearances and then we do start well, finish poorly. And so I had the capacity to sort of look good when people first met me. I've been overrated most of my life. But I had a job, grungy job, lousy job, working 10 at night, 6 in the morning, sweeping the floor in a mill. Lousy thing. But I was grateful for it. I kept it. because I knew I didn't need to get in the fast lane too quick. If I'd have got back into sales and traveling and this kind of stuff, I was pretty solid in the program, but I didn't want to take any chances. You know, I knew I needed the stability and the solidity of that kind of thing, so I stayed on that. I stayed on that job 2 years. And so it was things were going, you know, that there's a whole new life waking up. Got involved in my area. Some stuff happened. I want to tell you some stuff that happened, and it's not a, you know, I'm not Jack and the Beanstalks and the magic ghost, but I'm somebody who knows that miracles happen. I don't think it. I know it. And I know that when God's got work for me to do and there's something in the way, God will get it out of the way. I don't think it. I know it. And I'll tell you just a couple of things that happened, and you can take it to the bank. When I walked out, I'm just a guy. I don't want much. I want to be a citizen. I never had been. I was never anybody that added anything to the community. I tore communities down. I didn't increase property value. I lessened them by moving in the neighborhood. And so I wanted to be a citizen. I wanted to vote. I had never voted in my life that I know of. And I wanted to vote. And I vote now. I guarantee you, I vote, don't even know who's running. I mean, I'm not going to miss a vote. And I'll just pick a name I like. If I don't know them, I say, that sounds good to me. But I like that right of participation. And so I started doing that kind of stuff. And stuff happened, you know, that when I was released, I was on parole, and I'm on parole from a maximum custody institution. That means tight surveillance. And so went to work, doing what I'm doing. I had a great parole guy. And he came to me after I'd only been out a couple of months. And I'd gotten active it was simpler back then. Some guys asked me the second week, go over to the prison with us. We're trying to do some AA over there. Go with us. You could be helpful. I said, man, I'm not going back in a prison. I just got out. You know, for God's sakes. And I'm not crazy. And they leaned on me, and I said, all right, I'll go. But you better hope I get out. And so we had got started, and I was really active. Yeah, I mean, sure enough active. I was DCM 5 months after I was out. And so I'm rolling. My pro guy came to me about the second month, and he said, Tom, you real active in this AA thing? And I said, yes, sir. And it concerned me because I thought he might have some criticism about that. He wanted me to slow down. And I knew I wouldn't. Even for that, I wouldn't do it. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, it would, but I can't, like he didn't know. And you know, I'd had letters that big, this man's to never operate a motor vehicle. I accepted it as a fact of life. I never expected to operate a motor vehicle again the longest day I live. And accepted that, understandably. And so he said, wouldn't it help if you could drive? And I said, I can't. He said, let me check it out. And he called me just a little later, said, can you come to the Sears store uptown? This really sounds like hokey country for sure. The Sears store is where the counter was for the license. They didn't have an office. They had a counter in the Sears store. And so my sister drove me up, went in, walked back there. My guy was talking to a fellow I didn't know. They chatted just a bit more, and then they turned to me, and my pro guy introduced me to this fellow. And the guy said, Mr. Logan, my pro guy tells me that you might be interested in getting your license back. And I said, well, yes, sir, it would be nice, but I realize I can't. Now, don't ask me to explain it, because I can't. But I guarantee you it happened exactly like I'm going to tell you. And it absolutely is the kind of thing that convinces me, when God's got work for me to do, whatever the barrier is, it'll come down. It'll flat come down, and I know that. And so that guy asked me that, and I responded, and he handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I knew how to drive. I mean, nothing. No test of any kind, road written, verbal, nothing. Didn't even pay for it. That's not legal. It can't be legal. But I've been driving ever since. And so I can't explain it. I just observe it and report it. You know, that's exactly what happened. And so, you know, I'm nobody special. I'm exactly who I told you I was. You know, I wasn't a French poodle in disguise. I was a junkyard dog. And my history was not something you'd want to read too long. And so things are happening. I've given my life to this program, and it started to give me life what happened. And so I'm banging away and all that kind of stuff. And one day, I think probably the most startling thing I ever got was I got a phone call one day, and it was from the state capitol, the headquarters of the prison system in North Carolina. I knew they knew me because you know, the state of North Carolina had to agree to my being transferred to my home state. And so the guy called, they called and got on the phone. He was a fellow that worked in the headquarters of the prison system. And I think, you know, like a lot of times, managers will make a round and they'll visit facilities, see how it's going, commend or scold or whatever needs to be done. And he'd come by the when I was in the group, in working with the group that I sponsored. And I remember when he came in, and he just entered. I think somebody told him to pat me on the back and give me encouragement or something. I think that's what he was. And so, but I'd met him. I remembered his name. He identified, and I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Mr. Ivester, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position." Now, you know who's just been talking to you. It does not sound like somebody that a headhunter would be looking for, you know, that. And I said, "Do you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, we've checked you out, you know." And of course they had, yeah. And I said to him what I honestly believe. I said, "My God, man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine." And to myself, I said, "There ain't no way." As of the date of that phone call, there had never in the history of this planet been an ex-con hired as a professional employee in a prison system. It had never been done. And I knew that. I knew they weren't going to start with me. But they're going to have to start with somebody if they're going to do it. And I guess I was the only one standing there. And so the guy offered me that job. And I mean, I'm stunned. I mean, how could you possibly, could you imagine sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary and you start looking at your life plan and what your objectives are? Can you imagine somebody stupid enough to say, "Well, I think I'll get out here and run one of these places. Yo, I think I'll be in charge of the whole deal." Yeah. I mean, man, they'd put a net on you if you think it like that. And so I couldn't believe it, but he said that and gave me a report date, and I reported to work. Now, they didn't hire me. I don't know why they hired me. Nobody ever told me. Not a soul ever told me anything about what they were looking for. That they hired me. And nobody gave me a pep talk. Yeah, do you realize what a risk we're taking? You know, North Carolina is not Berkeley. You know, we are not a think tank. We are not on the cutting edge of new waves of technology and stuff. That is not us. You know, we're a redneck, conservative state, and I vote wrong every time, but nonetheless, that's who we are. And so I couldn't believe it. And so I report to work. And now, you believe us or not, it sounds absolutely unbelievable. But from the day of that first phone call until I retired from that system 39 years later, I never had a single person discuss my history with me. I mean, nobody. I thought they would surely say, "My God, man, do you realize what a responsibility we're putting on you? You realize what a risk we're taking? If you get in here and screw up, it's going to be headlines all over the world." Nobody said a word. Sometimes I thought, do they even know? I mean, my God. Well, they had to. North Carolina had to negotiate with Michigan to have me released from parole so I can accept a professional position in North Carolina. I still can't believe that. That is just so bizarre. And but nobody ever talked. In my entire career, not a single person ever discussed that history at all. They treated me like a professional. And I'd already made up my mind that's what I was going to be. Yeah, we were talking about traditions a lot this weekend. If I take 25 cents for some service I do in AA, I'm a professional. I may be a low-paid one, but I'm a professional. You don't sell this sucker, you give it away. And so I knew that if I accepted a salary, that I'd have my AA life, but I had a professional life. I had to make a quick decision. There's nobody to discuss it with. I'm the only guy on the planet that's had that experience. You know, I had lunch a while back with one of the guys that walked on the moon. And that what a thrill to have him describe that. I didn't tell him. I'll do it next time we eat. But I'll tell him next time, when he walked on that moon, that's exactly how I felt walking into that penitentiary as an official. I had some quick decisions. I could have gone in there and been some kind of a hoodlum hero and been on every tabloid in the world and with notoriety and all this kind of stuff, but I didn't want that. I wanted to be of service, and I wanted to be a professional. If I'm going to get paid as a professional, I'm going to be a professional. So those were decisions I had to make by myself with my higher power. Talk to my sponsor, but ultimately I had to make that decision. That I'm not going to be one of the guys in there with some major war story to tell. If I'm paid to be a professional, that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be the man. I can be a good one, but I'm going to be the man. There's no way around it. Those were just simple, definitive definitions that I had to work out. I went to work, and I'm going to tell you something that's hard to believe, but you can take it to the bank. Absolutely, everything I tell you is 100% true. I went in that job. I really didn't have any ambition. I was glad to be working. I'd finished 2 years not at Michigan State, but they had been in television while I was drunk. And I woke up. There it was. Howdy doody, jumping up and down. And Michigan State University sent college classes to the penitentiary. All you had to do was buy a couple of books and pay a little tuition. And I was a freshman, not at Michigan State, but from Michigan State. Finished 2 years of my college. I was a great student because I'm not a drug addict, but I sucked up an awful lot of speed. And I just like long parties. And speed will do that. I guarantee you, man. I get on one of those week-long tears, and I come out looking like a raccoon with those big circles around me. And now that stuff will do something to you. I'm not going to give a drug history here, but it does something to you. It screws up the wiring, the whatever it is that makes that thing work. And I couldn't sleep. There'd be just noise in my head and flashing stuff going. And I thought, jeez, I can't survive. One day, you hear some brilliant stuff in AA. One guy came into a meeting, and he said, when I came into AA, I couldn't sleep. Well, my little old ear just perked right up. And he said, but I learned something important about that. I heard a man say one time, if you can't sleep, stay awake. And I thought, what is a fool talking about, for God's sakes? Of course you're going to stay awake. And but you know, that made sense. I finished 2 years from Michigan State while I couldn't sleep. Man, I could go through a textbook in a week. I mean, I may not remember what I read, but I guarantee I could knock that sucker out. And thank you, Speed. I'm glad I'm not with you anymore. That it worked. And so that's what I'm doing. I went to work. And I had an unbelievable career. I never hear what I've already said. From the day I walked into AA and got my first job in recovery, I have never applied for one single job in my entire life. None. And went through a career that was unbelievable. I started out as a rookie rehabilitation officer, and I never applied for anything, but I got recruited for stuff. You know, people would see what I was doing and think maybe I had a little something to offer somewhere else. And so I got recruited. I got recruited into supervision and then into management. I did, in my spare time, manage to finish my education in correctional administration. But it wasn't very ambition. I just got tired of having such a goofy-looking resume. And I wanted something that had looked a little more coherent. So I finished it up and then went into management and then started directing some programs. And all of that is just absolutely no definitive kind of initiative to make any of that happen. And the one day, I think probably the most startling thing I ever had happen, and by then I was almost numb to surprises. But I was my office one day was in the same office with the director, and he called me and said, Tom, stop by the office. I've got something I'd like you to do for me. That normally meant pinch hit somewhere, you know, either teaching a class or speaking to a civic club or going to a unit to troubleshoot or whatever. He said, stop by. And I said, yeah, okay. So I went by, walked in, said, hey, boss. And I said, what do you need? He said, I wasn't prepared for this. But he said, after we had it, he said, Tom, I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden. And that still sounds ridiculous to me. And when I got up off the floor, I said, come on, boss, man, I don't want to be the head screw, for God's sakes. And he said, I don't want you to be the head screw. And so I said, well, what do you want me to do? And he told me. Now, he knew who he was going to. I'm not a manager. If you want somebody to manage and make the machine run right and produce the right number of parts, don't get me, because I'll have that sucker running sideways tomorrow. You know, I develop stuff. I make stuff happen. I create stuff. That's what I do. I'm not somebody who's just static and wants to watch widgets come off a line. And so he knew that. And he said, and I said, what do you want me to do? And so he told me. I won't go into details, but he had a vision. He was a strange man. He was a tremendously educated guy, professor in law school, great guy, cold-blooded scientist in a lot of ways. Took him to some AA meetings, and that dope could never catch on what it was doing. He'd say, well, why do they tell those stories? I said, just forget it. Just forget it. I'm not taking it anymore. So. But anyway, he's a guy, and he said, here's what I'd like to see. And he didn't have any blueprints or plans or anything like that. He said, I'd like to see a prison where a guy starts out in traditional confinement and then incrementally works his way through a process culminating with placement in a community. He said, I've never seen one, and I'd like to see one. That was the sum total of my job description, the sum total. There's an old definition of delegation that I always use, that find the right person for the job, tell him what you're looking for, make sure he's got the equipment or budget he needs to do it, and let him do it and just check up and see how it's going. That's a great definition of delegation. And that's exactly what he did. Here I am, out in the system, but I was not running something. You know, I'm a guy legally and I'm supposed to have a weapon. I'm going to be in charge of all of them. You know, and that's not supposed to happen like it, but just amazing what happened. And so he took me down to that prison and installed me as the warden. Well, I thought I'd be able to go back home and pack or, you know, get whatever, pray or something. Went out to the parking lot. He got in the car and drove off. And I said, hey, boss, wait, man, don't leave me down here with these fools. You know, but he did, left me there. And so that started a career. My career was essentially 39 years of it. And I essentially was the guy to go to for new stuff. Anything anybody else was too smart to tackle, he'd come to me or whoever the next one was and say, how about doing this? So I had an absolutely great career. Absolutely great. And rewarding, stimulating, challenging, and absolutely a super thing. And so it happened. And a truly, truly great career. That's a direct result of what we're doing here tonight. You know, now certainly there's no infiltration by anybody, anything like that. But the principles that I used in that career are the same principles we talk about here. And they do. It's what I use in every area of my life. And so it worked out well. And when I retired, I had already been elected to be the chairman for AA and Corrections, effective the day I retired. And so I had a marvelous retirement. It lasted about 12 hours. And then I went to work for nothing, except great rewards, and had the tremendous experience of I still do, of being up to my ears in trying to make AA an effective tool in prisons. You know, so that's a good deal of where I put my energy. I've been as active in AA as anybody I know, and we're not racing. But a lot of people worry about getting in too deep and getting into things, and how do you balance your life, and how do you get all everything fine-tuned and all that stuff. And I understand that. But I've been as active as anybody I know, and I can tell you this, there's absolutely nothing in my family or in my personal life that has been damaged one iota by my level of intense activity. When my wife and I just celebrated 42 years of continuous marriage. I can't believe it, but we did. And she celebrated too. I mean, she thought it was a good idea. And Got two kids. They're just like anybody's kids. I thought they were total airheads there for a while. And still not 100% sure. My my son is a physician, and he has his own service project. You know, he's been for the last few years on his own. I mean, he takes some time, just like we take time to do service. My son does that. He goes down. He's been going down to Ghana in Africa and training young Ghanaian physicians about how to operate at high-risk levels. And it's a specialty field, you know, and so I'm proud of that guy for doing that. And he just got back from, I believe you call it Malawi. Malawi is over by South Africa. Just got back from a tour there. So I'm very proud of that guy. My daughter's a psych major. We've got every hope that she's going to get back from outer space and we'll land on this planet. Now, she's a great gal, but she still hadn't been able to find the written niche that she really wants to do. And so she's doing social kind of work and this kind of thing. But it's great. I mean, they've done well. You know, this family's been good. And the point is that nothing in my life has been negatively impacted, and you couldn't be any more active than me. And so everything in my life has been enhanced 1,000%. And so when I finally retired and started doing chairing AA and corrections, I'll be in that up to my neck forever. But I'm not a one-dimensional person. I'm somebody who functions in all of our legacies in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am deeply concerned about cooperation with professional community, about public information, about treatment, all of the things that constitute the active program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am deeply concerned and dedicated about those things. And I plan to spend the rest of my life trying to contribute wherever and whenever I can to trying to strengthen those areas. And I do that not just because the board needs something to do, but there are things that we desperately need in Alcoholics Anonymous. I won't go into detail, but I'll just tell you this. It's things that I worry about that energize me to do things I want to do, and I hope it does you. You know, I'm somebody who is a strong believer in singleness of purpose. I believe that, just like Bob says at the end of his story in the book, that what we have that connects us is not information and agreement on concepts. What we have is identification. I was broken where you were broken. And sharing that is the most powerful gift I can ever give anybody. And I don't care how rationally we agree with people who are not in that context, it doesn't make that identification happen. And so I'm a deep believer in the value of singleness of purpose. I want to contribute everywhere I can, and to try to make sure that we stay what we're supposed to be. The other thing that I've got great concern about, and I would only just mention this to you because if you're looking for something to pay attention to, I'd earnestly suggest this one. We have changed enormously in the time I've been in AA. Yeah, you heard what I said about when I was getting AA going in that time. 12-step calls were about as regular as mealtime. And they're almost a lost art now. Yeah, I would bet that in this group, and in an enlightened country like Denmark, I would bet that in this group, at least 75% of people in this group have never participated in a 12-step call as provider or consumer. Now, I obviously have no way of knowing that. But that's typical of any gathering of AA today, that most of us have come through some sort of social system or referral process, or a husband or wife beat us over the head enough to get us to make a move. But I'm concerned about that. What we become is like when we did a lot of 12-step work, one thing that happened with that was a loyalty second to none. I mean second to none. When you go into somebody's pigsty, just like my wife and I did into the gal that I gave away in marriage, you've got to be prepared for that. And when you do that, it creates a bond of loyalty so that that person would not hesitate to do the same thing for somebody else. And that's rapidly going away. I'll give you one quick example. How are we doing? I got this. Okay. If I didn't talk so slow, I could get more in. But I'll just give you one example of what I'm talking about. I was speaking to a group in North Carolina one night, and a drunk woman came in. Now, I was standing up front, and the crowd had her back to her. And so I watched her coming in. I think a drunk woman's kind of exciting. You know, they always do something. I mean, it's just weird. And so she comes in, and she's singing when she comes in. Lousy singing, but she was brave. And she went back to the kitchen. She had to be drunk to go back there. And she's rattling stuff. Well, what was interesting, I was like the psychiatrist at the burlesque show. I'm watching the audience instead of the dancer. And I'm watching the group. The reaction wouldn't have been different than if it was the Women's Garden Club to how we reacted. Because what you had, rather than doing what you would instinctively do if you understood 12-step work, what we did was sit there and look at each other with that nonverbal stuff. You know, somebody needs to do something. Call 911. Call the emergency squad. Call the police. I mean, I've heard every bit of that in there. But the instinct to respond has waned and gone in many places. And finally, there was a gal there by the name of Marguerite who happened to be the oldest person in the barn, except me. And so she did what you do if you know what to do. She quietly got up, didn't disturb the meeting, went back, put her arm around that gal's shoulder, took her into another room and sat down and do what you do on a 12-step call. But you only do that if you know that. And so we've lost that thing in our fellowship appreciably. And so that bond of loyalty was so important. Back in those days, when a new group started, now I know in a city the size of this, you could start a dozen new groups, you may not even know it in the next month. But that happens in cities. But even in small town America, you start a group now, but back then when you started a group, it was like when a farmer got in trouble and all the other farmers would come in and help through the crisis. And so back then when you formed a group, everybody else came over to support, encourage, and help to get it going. And see, and that part's gone now. And what we have are groups that are just popping up, you know, all over the place. And really, often don't even know who their neighbors are, nor anybody knows that they're there. But it's just a change in that. We've changed from appreciably from good, solid three legacy groups where there's real work being done and all the legacies, unity, recovery, and service are being pursued full bore. Those groups are a rarity these days. I know that. They're a rarity. And I think it's a tremendous problem. That's something I want to do something about. And I hope you do too.
Oh, yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
All right. I think it is important. Because you and I, whether you want to or not, we're writing the next edition of the book. We're writing it right now. And we're either going to write a trashy piece of the history, or we're going to contribute. And so that's what I'm saying to you. I don't want to just talk to you about getting drunk, getting well, and all this kind of stuff. But I want to enlist you to that. You know, good chance I may never get back to Belgium. I beat people to death over here, so they probably never. Not Belgium. Why I keep trying to move y'all? You're in Denmark. Don't forget that. You're in Denmark. Yeah. But I want to get you into that cause, you know, and just contribute whatever I can. So that's what I do. That's what I do. And I'll guarantee you I'm having more fun than anybody I know. I work hard, but I have a ball. Today, I consider myself the most richly rewarded man on this planet. I truly do. I've been rewarded beyond imagination. And all it is, I just gave my life to a simple program, try to make my contribution where I can. And I'll tell you, the last thing I'm going to say to you is this, except individually. The last thing. That some people tell you when you come in here that you'll have a fairly predictable experience, that you'll come in and if you really get in the program, you'll sort of get on a pink cloud and have a honeymoon period. And that'll last some, I don't know what the term is, but it lasts some term and then it'll taper off into mediocrity or something. I don't know what it's supposed to taper off into. Well, I'm going to tell you that pink cloud or honeymoon thing lasts exactly as long as the things you do, not 1 second more nor less. It is good for a lifetime because it's a product of what we do in the last three steps, which have to do with getting my mind off myself, focusing on others, and trying to carry this thing forward. So good luck. Thank you.